Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I shall repay. And I think we're on a very interesting trajectory for that repayment now. This is Global Great Awakenings on globalfreedomtv.com. We're going to be joined by the great Mike Harris, and we're going to be discussing the terrorist attack that we just saw allegedly happening in Russia, in Moscow, that has been reported widely on terrorists that have been trained in Turkey, that came from Tajikistan, that shot up the theater and killed allegedly 133 people, and have been subsequently caught and now interrogated and are being prosecuted, and more networks are coming into play. Let me play a quick video before we jump right in, and then we'll take Mike Harris and we'll start exploring this. This was just done today, and Mike, I welcome your thoughts. Let me press the share sound, and there we go.
Let's cross live to former U.S. officer Scott Bennett. Scott, it's good to have you join me now. In his latest address, President Putin has said that we know who carried out the massacre at the Crocus, but the question remains, who ordered the attack? Now, with the investigation in full swing, what are your expectations based on what we know so far of who is behind it?
Well, based on what I know so far and what I've studied, I think there's no doubt Victoria Nuland ordered the attack. The U.S. State Department, the U.S. CIA ordered the attack in concert with the British MI6 and the Israeli Mossad. Let's never forget the Israeli Knesset member who threatened Rory Susich and the Russian people and the Russian Republic and the Russian government about a month ago and said, "You're next. We're coming after Russia next." Let's never forget the psychotic demonism that is being displayed in the Gaza genocide that the Israelis are doing. I think this is a convenient distraction away from their crimes there. So they benefit. The Israeli Mossad benefit. And I do think they have fingerprints because I know from my days in Iraq, the telephonic communications that are often used to spread psychological warfare were again employed yesterday by sending text messages to phones with young people and fake bombs and things being dropped off in hospitals and such. This is a psychological warfare to terrorize the Russian people and government in an attempt to discombobulate them. I think it'll backfire because no one really understands that the Russian people and culture are unified and probably stronger than most others on planet Earth because they've endured this sort of thing before. But I do think the Israeli Mossad had a role. They're very easy to infiltrate these countries where you have half semi-retarded individuals from Turkestan being recruited in the embassy of Ukraine in Turkestan and then trained in Turkey allegedly. The Israelis often can look at the NSA in a role in listening in the very least. And of course, Ukraine, which are just like chimpanzees at a computer console that don't know what the buttons or the levers do, but simply obey what they're told to do by their U.S. masters, they had a role. It seemed like these terrorists were aimed to get caught, though, when they were departing to go back to Ukraine, which is a very odd escape route because typically in these sort of operations, you don't make a mad dash escape. You hide, you disappear in safe houses or taxi cabs, or you try and become invisible and let the storm pass. They didn't do that. They rushed and tried to escape to Ukraine. So it tells me these people were sacrificed. They were also drugged up on Captagon. We know the Saudis brought Captagon into the Syrian operations, which is another reason that the Israeli Mossad are suspect because of Russia's heroic savior of Syria and President Bashar. And Turkey certainly doesn't have clean hands in this either. But I know Russia will handle it very delicately, but at the same time, very brutally when it comes to the punishment of all of these individuals that were involved, their families. And I think Medvedev's words should become both the ethos and the law of the Russian people and culture. But it's going to be exposed very soon. But what we know so far is definitely Victoria Nuland and the U.S. State Department, the U.S. CIA, and I'd say Israeli Mossad had very key roles in this Ukrainian terrorist operation against Russia.
All right, now the Russian president has raised some questions whether radical Islamist organizations are willing to intensify strikes against Russia. What are your thoughts on what Islamic terrorist motives will be if they are involved in this, as the narrative been pushed by the United States?
Well, that, of course, is why I suspect the Israeli Mossad and the CIA and such, because I've seen them up close and personal in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan recruiting these half-witted retards and turning their semi-lobotomized personalities into terrorist suicide belt-wearing fanatics, and then filling them with drugs to initiate the trigger operation. So religious extremism and fanaticism in the Islamic mind is very typical of the Mossad. They did this in Libya and elsewhere, but it doesn't reflect true Islam. It doesn't reflect the Sunni or the Shia, true Islamic Muslims, and that's how you combat it. So Russia needs to stand with the Islamic countries. Lavrov needs to go to Iran, to Iraq, to Jordan, to Egypt, to Turkey, to Syria, to every Islamic country, Indonesia, and let them all in a very chorus of support say, these terrorists do not reflect true Islam, and we are filing laws in our country that say if you are engaged in any sort of operations against Russia, you will get the death penalty, and your family will be persecuted as well. So Islamic terrorism needs to come from the Islamic countries. It needs to come from within, Islamic counterterrorism. So how you defeat Islamic extremists and stop them from being recruited by the CIA, by the Mossad, at embassies in places like Tajikistan and elsewhere, is you have those countries pass their own laws and make it very known that they are not going to be allowed to scar and blemish and defame the great name of Islam. They don't represent true Muslims. They represent the Mufsidun, the reckless false Muslims, and that needs to be said openly, publicly, loudly, and displayed throughout all of the Islamic television communication channels in an effort to stop that from spreading. And I think Russia is smart enough to do that.
All right, now the Russian president underlined that there is a trend of attacks against Russian civilians and infrastructure amid the Ukrainian failures on the battlefield. Do you also see this as a new pattern in what some U.S. officials have called asymmetric warfare tactics, and can that backfire on Ukraine losing any support?
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, I think you're prophetic, because you have just predicted what I think the next domino to fall is, and that is hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of volunteers from around the globe rushing to volunteer to help Russia fight these extremists and fight these terrorists in Ukraine. I saw this when I was in Donbass. I saw people from all over the world, South Korea, Japan, Serbia, Africa, Italy, joining the Russian volunteer army to fight fascism, to fight the globalist New World Order, rainbow flag, climate change extremists. Everyone of a free heart that desired liberty went and fought for Russia. And I think this terrorist act is going to result in thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people rushing and asking and indeed begging to join the Russian army and help Russia fight these fanatics because of this terrorist attack. And Russia can take the best and brightest of those people and put them to work. So I think it is going to backfire, because there are more people in more countries that are showing absolute support for Russia than anyone that can that stands silent or that even supports this. The only ones that support this, I would say, are Ukraine, the United States, Britain, Israel, France, Germany, the NATO countries. They shed crocodile tears, but they're liars. They've had a role in this. Victoria Nuland promised surprises on the battlefield. But I think it's going to backfire. I think you're going to have enormous support for Russia. Every country in the world is going to have people wanting to help fight this. Ukraine is a dead man walking. Zelensky is going to be buried very soon, if not and suffer a worse fate. Perhaps his ears and his reproductive organs need to suffer some of the same torturous experimentation that the terrorists just recently had at the hands of the Chechens. But I think you're going to see Ukraine very quickly disintegrate. And Russia, of course, is following its own plan. But I think Medvedev is right. They need to execute all of the people involved and quicken their tempo and their intensity to make sure this never happens again. And not a single person lives in the Ukrainian territory, which is part of Russia. No one lives in Ukraine that either sympathizes with these terrorists or has any support or inclination to do the same. Ukraine needs to be part of Russia, and anyone living in Ukraine cannot have any hostility towards Russia whatsoever. That should be the law of the land if anyone wants to return from Ukraine from their exodus over to European countries. And if they're not willing to do that, then Ukraine needs to be a new republic populated by new people. And I think, you know, it's going to be very interesting to see how this unfolds. But ultimately, Russia is the victor in this conflict. And that's why the NATO countries are so desperate for terrorist attacks, because they realize there's only a matter of days left, if maybe weeks, where Ukraine is even going to be recognized as a viable country anymore. There's nothing left. There's no institutions. There's no government. The parliament is about to be dissolved. It does raise a good opportunity for Russia to begin to cultivate within the Ukrainian parliament voices that are going to be rising up demanding Zelensky's expulsion, demanding a military takeover, and perhaps if a military takeover removes Zelensky as the fanatic and the suicidal megalomaniac that is trying to destroy every Ukrainian at the orders of the United States and Britain. Okay. Perhaps the Ukrainian army rose up, there could be peace, but we'll see.
All right, we'll wait to see what the future of Ukraine would look like after all of this.
So, Mike Harris, I'll get your comments on that. Essentially, what we're talking about was Mossad's involvement, Israel's involvement, the recruitment of Tajiks from the Middle East, their past similar operations. As well as this event, I'd welcome your thoughts on the validity of the event. What have you heard with regards to this Moscow event, and what is your summary analysis of what happens before we get into what will happen? Go ahead, Mike Harris.
Well, the first thing I look at, Scott, is the U.S. came out directly and said this is ISIS, and we all know from Syria that ISIS is a Mossad, CIA, Israeli operation, always has been. I recall on the show saying that while I was in Syria, I've shown TOW missiles manufactured by Raytheon in Tucson, Arizona. They were taken from ISIS Daesh, and so they're being supported by the U.S. There's fingerprints all over this. It was really a stupid comment on the U.S. part to try to pin this on ISIS, because those breadcrumbs lead right back to the U.S. CIA. It was really stupid, but they didn't want to throw their other prize stepchild under the bus by throwing Ukraine to it, because Russia would escalate against Ukraine. Let's look at the bigger picture here. Who benefits? The Khazars benefit, because they're the ones who want to depopulate Ukraine, because when the Jews are driven out of Israel, which is coming, they're going to have a place to go. And if Ukraine has no population or has a fraction of its former population, there's going to be a lot of real estate there that's going to be available very cheap. And so they're going to try to populate that. They want Khazaria back. Putin cannot allow that to happen under any circumstances, because it takes them right back to the pre-8th century situation they were in back then. And this time, we're living in a nuclear world. We're living in a biological weapons world. We're living in a much more dangerous world than it was back in the 8th century. And so Putin cannot ever allow that to occur. He's got to reclaim Ukraine and has to bring it back into Russia. And, just for the historical point, Kiev used to be the Russian capital of the Russian Empire. And that happened when the Mongol hordes came in and pushed them north. But people have to remember their history here. And, the Zionist Khazarians, Jews, whatever you want to call them, that's that tribe. They think they're entitled to that property. They want it back. And that's just the long and the short. They don't want any Russians or Slavics or anybody else there. They want to drive them all out. They want to kill them. They're very, very good at genocide. They've done it time and again. I mean, going back to the Armenian genocide, the Holodomor in Ukraine, where they starved the population, they wiped out the Cossacks, they wiped out the kulaks, they killed over 80 million, somewhere between 80 and 100 million Russian Christian men, women, and children. It's what they do. And when this thing swings the other way, you know, Russia has to remember who the real enemy is. And what Putin has not been as aggressive as he could have been is he doesn't want to kill the civilian population, which is really Slavic Christians, Eastern Orthodox. He doesn't want to kill them. You know, it's like our country here. We're primarily a Christian country, but we've got Jewish management running the show. I mean, they have infiltrated, they've taken over our Department of State, they've taken over all of our governmental apparatus. And so, you know, we're still good people, but we've got really bad management. The same thing when the Soviet Union, when after the Bolshevik Revolution, they were an evil empire, as Ronald Reagan said. And they were because they had management who was not acting in their population's best interest. They're only acting in their own best interest. And if there is a flaw in their model, that's their flaw. They don't know how to act to the benefit of the populations that they infiltrate themselves into. Their reception would be much more favorable if they would do that. They might even be tolerated. But behaving the way they do, ultimately, when they try to swindle people and genocide people, they don't get a very warm reception of that. You know, they corrupt every culture they touch, and they don't act as protectors of their culture or of the culture they're inhabiting. They act as destruction to it, and so they're never well received. They were kicked out of what, you know, 11, 1200 countries or 130 countries, 11 or 1200 times. But yet they always worm their way back in, and so we're stuck with them. So, you know, I you know, what is the solution to this? How do we deal with this long
Well, let me
term?
ask you first before you do that. So, do you think this was a Mossad Israeli operation operating within the, you know, the auspices of the State Department, CIA, you know, Ukrainian intelligence? I know when I was at the State Department, there were a lot of Jewish Zionists everywhere there. I remember Emily Goldman at the State Department coordinator for counterterrorism's office that I worked under, and she always had a nervous tick about her. This eye flinching, which was very weird. But do you think it was an Israeli Mossad operation coordinated?
Well, let me say this. All right, back when Trump was preparing to run for president back in 2015 campaigning, the CIA was forbidden to spy against him. So what did they do? They had the Five Eyes. They had Britain, they had Australia, they had Canada. They had them spying against him. You know, so they were doing what the US CIA was forbidden to do domestically. Okay? Something similar is going on here with this. There is organized Jewry around the world, and they will form these project groups to accomplish things. It doesn't matter if it was Mossad or if it was CIA. There's a Jewish subculture within all of these organizations that takes them out to go out and do things that the government may not approve of, but this cadre within the government approves of. Like you said, Victoria Nuland. I don't think that this was a sanctioned thing that she did. I think it's something she went off the reservation to do. And so she used her friends in other countries, other organizations to get done what she couldn't do directly since she had left the State Department. And so you look at this and say, is Mossad involved? Well, indirectly, but yes, they are involved. And is Victoria Nuland a Mossad asset? You tell me. I think she might be. I think it's probably highly probable that she is. And so
Every dual
you
Israeli citizen is an asset, every
yes.
single one of them.
Well, I not just the dual Israeli citizens, but you know, any Jew out there is they'll
Yes.
always do anything for Israel. They'll drop what they're doing to help Israel. It's how they are. But what I'm trying to get to is that there is within the intelligence agencies, there's another intelligence agency. That is without the boundaries you have. If you're a US CIA guy, you've got the boundaries of what the US CIA is. If you're an Israeli Mossad guy, you've got the boundaries of what, you know, Israel's objectives are. But if you're this separate group that's within all of these organizations. You're not the dominant force, but you're an influencer within all these organizations. You can do these things discreetly, off the books. You can use each other's assets. So, well, I can't get my fingerprints on that, so you have to do it for me, and they will. And that's probably likely what happened here. Now, if I can see this, I guarantee you that Putin's intelligence guys, who are probably much smarter than me, can see it as well. So he knows what he's dealing with. He's probably getting accurate intel on this. Now, you have to remember, Putin's got some insiders in there that are working against his efforts as well. So every country in the world has this infestation, this Jewish Zionist Khazarian infestation. And every country in the world, we're going to have to unilaterally crush them if we want to be free of them. And so that's.
What do you think Putin's going to do to turn this into a positive, an advantage, a force multiplier? How is he going to exploit this to advance and achieve his missions?
Well, domestically, I watched Newsmax the other day, and they had some brigadier general, U.S. Army retired, on, and he was going on that, Putin needed to do this to create a false flag so he could get support for what he was trying to do in his country. He just won an election with 75% turnout. He won 80%, 87% of the vote, overwhelmingly popular. Now, what this has done is anybody who voted for Putin is thoroughly galvanized for the cause right now. I mean, I was told by one of my contacts over there that the Russian bear is awake and he's pissed. And so that's what's happened here. So, there's anybody who was sitting on the side and sort of watching and saying, well, the war is going on. The special police action, excuse me. It was that. Now it's a war. Putin said so.
Well, it's
Anybody
even
who
more than a
was.
war, isn't it, Mike, when they start cutting off ears and electrocuting the balls of these guys? I mean,
No,
we're
that's
now.
the. That's that, that 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 that's minor. That's noise. But what this has done is domestically, Putin's support is stronger now than it was last week during the election because of this. I mean, the general was right. It did boost Putin's support greatly, but he didn't need it. I mean, he was already immensely popular, way more popular than any. If a U.S. politician got that kind of voting, they'd say, oh, he has a mandate like never seen before.
But
And
what
that's
does
what
it do
Putin
for him
had.
internationally? What is it? That's, you're right about
Well,
the domestic support, but more
internationally.
importantly, what does it do for him internationally in the eyes of the Muslim nations, the BRICS nations, and the individual volunteers that have been helping him fight Ukraine? As I predict, it's going to multiply these volunteers immeasurably.
Well, internationally, it anybody who was on the fence looking at Russia, see, maybe Russia was the aggressor. Anybody who's saying that, say, and now they say with good reason. It justified the Russian cause 100%, because when you're going to go out and kill 133 civilians, and you've got, you wounded 180 civilians, you've got, 400, almost 400 people dead or wounded out there out of this one incident. And you were correct. Victoria Nuland did say, we have a lot of surprises for Putin. And so this is what she means by surprise. And so you've got this hidden organization that works behind the scenes within other intel organizations. So there's a group within a group, and this is all Jewish. They'll never trust you, they'll never trust me, but they trust each other. And so anybody who's got that bloodline in them, that tribe, is going to be tainted now. And so what Putin needs to do is make that clearly known, that the people who were behind this, who they were, where they are, and get every country to examine their own intelligence organizations to find out who's truly loyal to their country and find out who's working these side jobs for this other agenda that's not a U.S. agenda. It's not an Israeli agenda. It's the Jewish agenda to take back Ukraine and reestablish Khazaria.
Do you see an Operation Gladio 2.0 coming into the mix where, as we know, in the 1950s, the US CIA set off bombs and explosions in Italy and Europe and blamed it on the Soviet Union, blamed it on the communist Russia at the time, to motivate the European countries to become subservient and obey everything the US wanted to do on the foreign policy. Operation Gladio was basically false flags and blaming it on Russia, when in actuality it was the US CIA setting off bombs and stuff. So do you see a similar reaction by the West when, let's say, how Russia is going to react, what they're going to do, what bombings, what attacks, what killings, what, how are they going to exercise their strategic advantage? I don't mean vengeance. I don't mean emotional, hysterical tirades. That's not in the Russian character. But Russia is going to turn up the heat in a strategic way. And the question is, as Russia turns up its heat and advances and does things, how is the West going to react, and what are they going to do? And I'll just put this out there. My feeling is the West is going to pretend that, or set up situations where they orchestrate suppressions of our own people. They try and say the Russians just blew up a shopping mall in South Dakota because they're pissed off. They think that we had something to do with the Russian attack. So as a result, we're going to DEFCON 2 kind of a thing. How do
No,
you see the West, Operation Gladio and the tit for tat? What's going to
you're,
happen?
well, you're crossing multiple topics here in multiple situations. So let's go back to the original one. What is Putin going to do next?
Yes.
If the West insists on doing an Operation Gladio type operation within Russia, more terrorist attacks like this, Russia may, and this is what I would do. If I was Putin, I would activate Operation Sandman. If you're not familiar with that, that's where all the BRICS countries and the global South, who hold U.S. Treasury bonds, demand redemption the same day and break the U.S. Treasury, break it. Bankrupt it, show them for what they are, and then suddenly U.S. dollars don't buy anything. That will throw a major wrench in the works as far as everything global. Now, the BRICS will probably be able to withstand it pretty good, and the lesser developed countries will be able to withstand it very well. The industrialized West, the US and Europe are going to be toast. I mean, toast. China's not going to sell anybody anything for worthless pieces of treasury paper, treasury notes anymore. Not going to happen. And so global trade will break down, and the US will starve from within as well as Europe. And so they will not be able to fund or focus on funding any more trouble in Russia. That's one that that's if I was Putin, I would be getting that ready to go, because if there's any more of these type of incidents, you can't put up with it. You got to protect your people, and if you've got to destroy the global financial system, you go ahead and you destroy it to make it stop. And that will bring your enemy to bear. I mean, think about what would happen in the U.S. here if the U.S. Treasury bonds are refused. All those container ships sitting in Long Beach are going to turn around and go back to China. They're not going to deliver stuff. They're not going to give it away. They're going to demand commodities in exchange from the U.S., whether it's gold or grain or cattle. They're going to want something back that is tangible and will no longer take paper in exchange for the U.S. and from Europe, because the euro is based on the dollar. That's where it gets its value. And so you would see a very dramatic reordering of the global financial system very, very quickly, with the U.S. losing that round, very strongly losing it, and losing its dominance as global reserve currency. So that is one issue. Now, your second issue you brought up, which was about what's going to happen in this country. Are they going to have mass shootings in South Dakota and claim that the Russians did it? That becomes a more distant option if they exercise Sandman. Because what happens when the EBT cards don't get refilled and the Social Security checks don't go out and the military doesn't get paid because the US doesn't have the money to cover the expense? What happens then? We just saw this $1.2 trillion continuing resolution go through the House. All of those programs are going to come to a screeching stop. Nothing's going to move forward at all in the U.S. We're going to be stuck in our own mud here. So you collectively look at these things, and you can expect a great deal of civil unrest. We've got all these millions of illegals in the country who've been getting a free ride. What happens when the hotel they're staying in doesn't get paid? What happens when the food vendor who's been feeding them doesn't get paid? What happens when they don't get their EBT cards refilled that month? All of these things are going to happen. And in the U.S., these inner cities, particularly the blue cities, but every city, it's going to be a nightmare, because you're going to have people of limited intelligence, or let's just say below average intelligence. You don't have a lot of people with high IQs collecting welfare and EBT and all this. It just doesn't happen. Okay. But you're going to have your lowest common denominator in society out there is going to be pissed off and hungry. And it's going to become unmanageable very, very quickly. And so you're going to look at what they see in like you put rats in a cage and you don't feed them enough. They get really vicious with each other. They start killing each other, eating each other. And so we might see a lot of that, So the U.S. may not be the place that the Haitians want to come to anymore. So, they can be cannibals in their own country. They don't come here, need to come here to do it. So, well, but these are the type of things I see happening or potentially happening. I can't say I see them happening. Potentially, these are potential outcomes that could happen.
Well, you can predict this pretty simple. These are gaming out options. You can tell tit for tat. This happens. This is the reaction. This occurs. This is what is going to transpire. This is what, like you said, the EBT cards. These are measurable predictive actions that you can sociologically map out. What happens in Oakland? Okay, how many EBT cards do you have in LA and Oakland and New York and elsewhere? Housing, all this stuff. What happens when these are shut off? What happens when you turn the lights off? What do these people do? And these people, psychographically, demographically, Black, Hispanic, Jungle Bunnies, Banana Republic, ignorant, knuckle dragging, criminal minded, whatever you want to call them, not decent, cultural, educated, positive people, predators, criminals, that are simmering, that will boil over the moment the resources are shut down, and will go into criminal mode, violent mode. And then what do people around do as a result? Do they, quicken, leave the state? Do they pack up and leave? Does a family suddenly go, okay, we got to get out of San Francisco or New York? Or do they get equally violent to control the violent? Let me play another quick video. And this is
Scott, let me, you just made a point here. And that's one thing our government knows how to do really well, is to impose violence upon people. I mean, we may not have won Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam or any other confrontation we've been in, but they know how to impose violence, and they know how to calm a population in an area temporarily. And so if this happens, expect to see massive actions against it, just to suppress it. And then when they leave, it'll start back up again.
Let me play what Russia is doing currently with the immigrant populations. These are immigrants that are being kicked out of the country. Those are Russian police, Russian military. Let's watch it again because it's what America is. These are immigrants being rounded up, herded by military out of the country. And yeah, these are coming to me from Russia, by the way, people that are on the ground there. I would come to, when these things start happening, where are the epicenters going to start to really explode and decay?
Scott, let's back up again for a second, because you asked me, what would Putin do? And the thing is, I'm sure Putin has read Sun Tzu. And, to win a war, you don't want to go in and fight and have your men fight their men. You want to win the war by never, ever, casting or throwing a blow or a strike, or you don't want to have to do that. Putin, if he brings down the U.S. financial system with Sandman, and brings down the entire Western banking system. And this is all the Rothschild central banks globally. Remember, Russia is out of that morass now. China's two-thirds of the way out of it, and these other BRICS countries are also getting out of it as well. So why would he want to do anything hot? No nuclear strike, no bombing raids. No. He doesn't have to do that. All he has to do is bring down the financial system. And if he does that, the U.S. will self-destruct and no longer be a competitor on the global chessboard. It's pretty simple. I think he's going to follow the Sun Tzu adage there, where you never fire a shot. Why should he? You can break their banks. So that's
well, Sun Tzu talked a lot about spies, using spies, and I'm not talking about cloak and dagger spies, but in a sense, you have indigenous populations in Europe, in the United States, that are sympathetic, and if not supportive of Russia because of its support for traditional family values and Christianity. They see Russia as, and I saw this when I was in Donbass, people were going to fight for Russia and joining its volunteer army to fight against Ukraine because they were avid supporters of Russia's pro-family traditional value stance. This was told to me. We're fighting for Russia because it's the last of the uncorrupted countries that is not infected with the Soros globalism and stuff. This is what they are saying, not me, not you, people in South Koreans, Japanese, others that were in Donbass, wearing the Russian uniform, carrying AK-47s, going to Soledar and Gorlovka to fight and kill Ukrainians. So I anticipate this vastly growing, but how does Putin take advantage of this to speak to the indigenous people of these countries? What do you think he's going to say to the people in Europe and the United States in the coming days, weeks, months, and years? Because if you follow the Sun Tzu model, there's a very specific script.
You froze up there, Scott.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, there
Testing.
you go. You're back.
Okay.
Your face isn't moving, but I can hear
So
you.
yeah, I'm just wondering, what do you think, following that Sun Tzu script, what do you think, Putin, and it's not about Putin because he's got a lot of smart people around him, like you said, Peskov, Zakharova, Lavrov, many, many others, but Medvedev, what are they going to be communicating and saying to the people of Britain, to the people of France, to the people of Germany, to the farmers, to the American farmer, the Canadians, Australians? What are they going to be communicating to the indigenous populations that support Russia, that don't support Macron or Schultz or Biden? How do you see the communication game evolving?
Well, at least two levels, maybe more. The first level is the formal diplomatic level. Like you mentioned, Lavrov. I mean, anything with any heads of state, any of that, through the UN, all of those conventional channels. But since we're living in the age of the internet, the Russians are very good at that, there's a lot of things that they can do as far as communicating on the alt media, which is another way of communication. Because the mainstream media in this country and in Europe, they're propaganda arms. They don't tell the truth anymore. So you can get the message out truthfully through the alternate media, and you can use guys like whoever some of them are, to spread the message you want. And clear thinking, discerning people will see the message, and they'll see the value in the message. And people who have clear minds can they don't care if it comes from a Russian. If it's a truthful message, it's truthful. Whereas we know our own government lies to us about every damn thing there is. I mean, if they say it's going to rain, you better go outside and look. I mean, it's kind of like that. And Biden telling us our economy is doing great, and he's fixed all this and all these jobs, and he's a lying sack of shit, and we know it. And so our own government is self-destructing. The other thing Sun Tzu said is that when your enemy is self-destructing, let him do it. Let him go. Don't stop him. Let him complete the job. And so we've got that element going on. But I really think that with the internet as it is now, it doesn't matter where the message comes from, as long as it's a truthful message, because that's what people need. We need to see the truth. That's why you're on here. That's why I'm on here. I mean, do I have the truth? I tell it as close as I can. Do I have all the information? I'm missing massive blocks of information. I guarantee you I'm missing massive blocks. Would I be saying different things if I had different information? Probably would. But right now, with the information I have, I tell the truth as I perceive it, as close to
Well,
factual as I can get.
and let's review that, I'll let you fill in the blanks. But the general broad stroke of the truth is, when you go back concerning the Ukrainian theater, when you look at, here's the portrait, here's the picture, here's the painting of Ukraine-Russia conflict. And most people I know, everybody watches our program and other programs like Alex Jones, Jim Fetzer, Rumble, Tucker. Everyone who's on the alternative media is pretty sharp. They're not the lobotomized retards, waving the rainbow flag and telling their boys to cut off their penises and the girls to tape their breasts. That's not the audience, and I certainly don't want them watching this program. I do, just because it would torment the idiots, but most people who watch our program are very, very conservative. But you see, the whole story, the whole painting of Ukraine-Russia conflict is very simple. You can go back to the 1940s and 50s, where they tried to cultivate enmity against Russia. The Ukrainians were actually recruited by the German Nazis and started killing Poles and Jews and gypsies and all the rest of that, and then pushed through Ukraine up into Russia, were pushed back and destroyed. They did some horrific things to the Russian people back there. It's amazing that the Poles conveniently forget all this. But that was settled in 1945, but yet it wasn't extinguished. The fire was smoldering from 1950 onward. And they in 20 in 1990 and beyond, that fire, that smoldering smoke, started to ignite. And Kirkpatrick under Reagan, you know this better than anyone, they started fanning the flames of this fire, this Ukrainian independence, and writing books and developing educational materials and lectures and curriculums and all this that started to brainwash everybody that was born in the 1990s or of 10 years of age up, and it made them see Russia as the enemy and the problem, and everything wrong that happened to them was a result of Russia. And then that quickened into,
Let me interject when you have a break.
2005. They did the color revolution, the orange revolution. And then from 2005, 2007, and 2012, 2014, they planted biochemical labs. And then in 2014, they did the coup d'etat in Maidan and put in replacing Yanukovych with Poroshenko, and then Poroshenko with Zelensky. But this entire conflict has been born out of the rape of Ukraine by the United States in the monstrous seed that was planted there that has now become a complete Frankenstein. So that's the history. That's the broad stroke of the truth is of what's happened. Now the question is, how is that all going to be rolled back, demolished, cleansed, and out of this ash heap, some kind of a new growth, new blossoming that has people that want to live in peace with Russia rather than animosity. But I'll end it there and hand it to you. Go ahead.
Well, let's go back. You mentioned Reagan and Jean Kirkpatrick, and I was alive and politically active during that time, so I can speak about this. That was still during the Cold War, and you have to remember that the Soviet Union is not Russia. The Soviet Union was a result of the Bolshevik Revolution when they came in there and killed the Tsar and tried to reform the entire country. So, doing it at that time, trying to split Ukraine independent from Russia at that time was different than what it would be today, because we were fighting essentially the same Bolsheviks, the same communists who are the same Jews who've infiltrated our own government here now. I mean, we sort of switched roles with Russia. We were the good guys back then, we become the bad guys now. And we're doing what the Soviet Union was back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. We've taken over that role of being the bad guys because of the Jewish influence within our government that they had previously to this. Okay? So when the Berlin Wall came down and things opened up, the U.S. sent their financial experts in there to really rape and pillage the country. Putin's a guy who prevented that. They got some of it out, but they didn't get as much as they were hoping for. They got some, but Putin's a guy who stopped that. Now, I was in Ukraine 2004, 5, 6, and 7. I was there for the Orange Revolution. I was there for the election whenever Viktor Yanukovych got defeated. What was that guy's name?
Who was
Timoshenko?
Was it or not
yeah.
Timoshenko? Something like that.
So I was there during that time. I remember being in my hotel room in Odessa and getting woken up at 6 o'clock in the morning. There was marching bands going down the street and 20,000 people behind them supporting Yanukovych. And so, I look at those times as that was another stolen election. I think Yanukovych won it then. I think he could have won. And I don't think they would have had a chance if Yanukovych would have been a little straighter player, if he'd have been a little, they say corruption, but the West always says that. So I can't personally comment, was Yanukovych corrupt or not? I don't know. Let's just accept it at face value and say that maybe he was. If he'd have been a little straighter with these people and wouldn't have put up with the corruption and the what they call the mafia over there, and
Yes, that was.
a little tighter on that, he wouldn't have had, they wouldn't have given the Orange Revolution and the Maiden Revolution chances to take root and flower. So, those are things that have to be done. What we're hearing here as a consistent theme is that globally, people do not want criminal government. We don't want corrupt government. We want clean government. And that's one thing that Putin appears to be able to offer, is a clean and focused government. Is it perfect? I'm sure it's not. I'm sure he's got his problems with corruption like any other government in the world does. But he's not as bad as the US is today under Biden. And so, how do we measure these things? But I just wanted to make that correction going back to the Reagan era, because that's important, because we did not want the Soviet Union style Bolshevism, which it still was, to come and spread in the rest of the world. We wanted to damage them. We wanted to hurt them. Russia today is not the same entity as it was back in the 70s and 80s. It has transformed itself. They're one of two governments in the world that have been able to shake off the Western banking system. It's Russia, well, actually three: Russia, North Korea, and Iran. They're the three who have rejected the Western banking system and want nothing to do with it. And now they're forming the BRICS, and they're creating a benevolent environment for these other third world and second world countries, India, and the other Brazil, to come in and join, where they can do business and not be excluded from the global trade, global commerce. And so that's what's happening. We're looking at a replacement of the Western banking system and the Western commercial system. That's what is finally happening. And it's going to be painful for us here in the US for all the reasons I said earlier about the collapse of that and what happens when the US can't make payroll and pay EBT cards and Social Security checks anymore. It's going to be extremely painful, but it's going to be better for us as a people and better for us as a country in the long term, because the banking system has stolen so much from every US citizen. It's incredible. And we were a better, more vibrant country before the creation of the IRS and before the creation of the income tax. So we need to we have we're going to have an opportunity here to repeal these things and roll them back. And what you'd be able to enjoy the fruit of your own labor without paying a tax to fund government debt that shouldn't exist. I mean, our government has failed in its mission of printing and coining our own money. Why do we need the Federal Reserve? Why did we outsource that critical job to give these people power over what our
Well,
government does?
but see, that's the thing, Mike. There are these deeply entrenched institutions that have been put in place since 1913 that are never going to be willingly taken out other than through the means of civil war and revolution and violence. Because the moment you have Kennedy or Lincoln type persons making decrees on the floor of the Congress, they will be assassinated, right? Or they will be the Jewish Israeli AIPAC will focus on removing them from office, or they'll use the instruments of democracy. They'll fix the game. They'll fix the little slot machine and say, "Oh no, you didn't win," or whatever. they have controlled the game, like you've said, the Jewish Zionist embedded blood poisoning into the instruments of national power are so deeply rooted. These the feds and these groups and the CIA and I saw it at State Department. I don't think there's a way to remove them. They're like cancers. And I always put people, you know, go to the Indian black salve. It kills cancer by putting it on the spot. It kills it and it expels it. Mm-hmm. I think these institutions, these Zionist sort of institutions that have corrupted our country, are only going to be burned out by violence. And I don't mean...
Let me go back. Let me go back. Yeah. Because if Russia does this Operation Sandman, it breaks the international banking system. Suddenly, they've lost their way to bribe and hire contract murderer, and you know this.
Good point.
All their tools are gone.
It's like pouring sugar into their gasoline source.
It takes away their ability to do business the way they do business.
Yeah.
If that happens on the outside, and we have a civil movement on the inside that wants these fundamental changes to our system, I think that it eliminates their ability to assassinate and to murder the leaders who are going to come forth, because they don't have the money to pay for it anymore. All they have to do now is run the printing press and print as much as they can. If Sandman goes into effect, they're going to have to pay the assassins in gold or some other commodity. And that's going to be a lot harder to do than if it is just paper. And maybe pay them, it's going to be very difficult for them. It's going to change how they do business.
So the states. So if Operation Sandman went into place and you had this complete implosion of the bubble, you know, how do the states begin to grow their own economy, their own currency, the good, the gold and the silver, the you know, a trade barter? I mean, here's a chicken for a case of beer, or here's a case of beer for a bottle of penicillin, or whatever it is, the trade and barter system. How do the states, the individual republics, because I guarantee you, the states that have their shit together, the republics have their stuff together, like Texas or Arizona or maybe Wyoming or whatever, who say, okay, we're independent of the Fed and independent of the gold. We don't accept the dollar. We're growing our own Montana gold certificate or something. Well, how would you say the states need to grow the good to push out bad money, as Hayek and a lot of economists have said, grow good money to push out the bad money?
Well, there's two things they can do. One of them is open up state bank. I think South Dakota did that. They've got a state bank. Every state should have a state bank. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, like Arizona, Texas, and a couple others have done, is they've already passed laws that allow them to coin money out of gold and silver, real gold and silver. And so these laws are now on the books. They exist. They can coin money, and these are fair and legal for trade. And so they've already taken the preliminary steps. Some states have. Every state's going to have to do something like it. Now you're going to have states like New York and California that are probably going to lag, and their people are going to suffer for it, and that more are going to leave because they want to go with someplace where you can actually do business and actually have coinage. But these things are going to happen. The hooks and handles have already been created in various jurisdictions. Now that those hooks and handles have to be duplicated and spread throughout all 50 states.
Yeah, I can see that. And it leads to the final analysis. What is China going to be doing during all of this? Are they actively invading the United States? Are they having a young military-aged army that is secretly being embedded? Are they going to be commanding the Hispanic Banana Republic and Haitian Third World zombies? The Chinese going to take control of them and tell them to do maneuvers? How do you see the Chinese... what is their goal during this?
If Sandman goes into operation, China is going to have their own set of problems financially. They're going to have their own issues. Their economy is already in deep trouble. This Evergrande situation has never resolved itself. It's still out there bubbling, and they're trying to keep that house of cards together. Truthfully, who I see is more of a hostile force than China right now, too, as far as getting into a hot shooting war, is Mexico. Yeah. Because, you know, the Mexico has been very clear that they do not wish to honor the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo any longer. For those of you who don't know, that was the Mexican-American War settled in 1840, actually signed March 15th, 1845, that gave us our current borders for Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. They want the old back. They want to go. They want all the way up to Sacramento. You know that they want back. They want to carve out a big chunk of U.S. territory. Mexico wants it. They've been very clear about that. They don't even make any bones about it. The other thing that people don't know, and I'll toss this out here. I think I may have mentioned this before, but you know we give citizenship to anybody who's born in the U.S. You know that 14th Amendment. We just anchor baby citizenship is what, let's just call it that. The Mexican Constitution explicitly states that if a Mexican is traveling abroad and the wife or the husband or either one of them has a child while overseas, their constitution states that that child is automatically and primarily a Mexican citizen first before he's anything else. So we have all these anchor babies here that are going to be dual Mexican-American citizens. And doesn't matter where they live, if Mexico succeeds in their gambit to take carve a chunk off out of the U.S. and renege on the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. But I see Mexico really is more of a threat to our sovereignty as to our actual occupying the land than I do China right now, because China has their own set of issues. They have their own set of problems. They're, like I said, they're a house of cards trying to keep it together the same way the U.S. is.
Well, I would agree with you, and I would come back to my experience in, as living in California, and I know you're in the Southwest. The West is a different animal than the East. I would tell everybody, move west of the Mississippi, and I don't think there's anything valuable anymore on the East Coast, certainly not up in the Boston, Maine, Vermont, that whole shithole of the Northeast that is emblematic of New York. And I don't think anything on the eastern seaboard from the Carolinas or anywhere, even down to Florida, are worth staying in. Florida could be wiped out with a weather weapon. But I think the best places and the safest places are west of the Mississippi, the West. But I would say the Chinese have a conservative character. You know, there's a traditionalism in the Chinese mentality that doesn't exist in the Hispanic culture, the Hispanic hot-blooded Latino, whatever you want to call it, and some are good, but you have a lot of scumbags that rape, you know, little girls until they don't have a vagina anymore. Chinese don't do that. Only the Hispanic Latinos do, and a lot of them are you know, demoniacs. So I think the Chinese have a certain cultural disgust towards the Latin, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, demonism, Catholic, whatever. But would you agree with that, Mike, that there's a difference in the mentality and culture and personality between the Chinese and the Hispanic?
Oh, absolutely. The Asian personality is entirely different. I mean, the Japanese are probably the most reserved. And the example I'll give you is you look at how the blacks in the U.S. Behaved during Hurricane Katrina.
Yes.
And you look at how the Japanese behaved during the earthquake in Kyoto.
Yeah.
Night and day difference. There was no looting. There was no robbery. There was no vandalism. There was no rape. There was no murder. The Japanese were there to help each other get it back together and you know, get life rolling again. Whereas, you know, the blacks in Louisiana were out there to grab anything that wasn't nailed down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I look at the Asian character is very different. And I think there are some genetic issues with that. And I can't identify what they are, but I think there is some genetics to it. And the Chinese are a very close second as far as being reserved and being polite. But when they go out of that mode from being reserved and polite, they are methodical, mean killers, man. The Asians are, there's, you know, none who are quite as good at it as they can be. And they can be very brutal at the same time. I mean, you know, if you've got information, they want it. They will get it out of you. I mean, they will break you. I mean, that's a given. And they're not afraid of losing lives. They have such a surplus of life over there. I mean, China in particular, they're not afraid of losing 10 million people. That would not be too heavy of a price to pay if it would accomplish a strategic objective for them. Whereas the U.S., we would never tolerate those type of losses, ever. So there's these are things we got to think about. And Michael Yon, I heard him a month or so back. I heard him say, talking about the situation in Darien Gap, and he said, you got to look at who's coming in this country. And he said, not all fish are meant to live in the same aquarium. Some fish are going to eat the other fish, and that's what's happening in this country. We've got fish that are not suitable for our culture coming into our country. And they jumped all over Trump for saying that they're poisoning the blood of our country. Well, they are. I mean, we can't be bringing Haitian, can't be allowing Haitian cannibals to come into this country. We can't be allowing these mestizo Indian types coming out of the jungles of Colombia and Venezuela to come up here and expect them to behave. We're going to have our hands full managing these savages. And these are brutal people. And they're not that smart, and they don't value life, and they're not afraid to die.
Let me ask you a final question. Are there countermeasures and weapons, crowd control weapons from microwave to sound speakers to any sonic weapons that could be used to repel the crowds, the hordes coming into the United States? I mean, I've seen some military technology that fires microwave weapons and it heats up the people and the crowds disperse. Are there technologies that could be used to arm the border? And if you don't want to fire, bullets at people or put landmines or drop napalm on them, why can't you use these alternative technologies to repel them? Are there technologies that could be used?
Well, I'm sure there are. I mean, the whole thing you're talking about, these weapons that the closer you get to it, the hotter your skin feels. These things. I mean, those could be easily deployed. Just have to scale up and put them out there. That you get too close, it's going to be very uncomfortable for you, to where the point you think you're going to die. And so that's that is one step. But like I said, I think that we need to create a maybe a 50-mile DMZ in Mexico, and not allow anything to come across that border at all. I mean, just
Yeah.
it was not authorized, it doesn't cross. And we've got checkpoints 50 miles in, every major road, everything. We shut these cartels down. I mean, give me the resources, I'll have it done, and I'll have it started with right away. Within 90 days, you'll see a difference. Within 180 days, I'll have it sealed. I mean, sealed. And there will be no more illegal fentanyl coming in. You want GM auto parts coming in? We can approve those and get those cleared to ship. And we will go through every package that comes through there to make sure that there's no drugs or other contraband in there. It can be done. There's no question about that.
Mike
So.
Harris, always an honor to have you on with us. Thank you so much for joining us in Global Freedom TV. We will see you tomorrow. God bless you.
Thank you, sir.